This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar. Let freedom ring. Let the
white dove sing. Voices from the Edge will be interviewing Paul Gorski on white privilege and racism on Thursday from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. Tune in to listen to the interview regarding race, privilege, anti-racism, anti-poverty activism, education, women's rights, immigrants' rights, and more. That's Voices from the Edge, this Thursday from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m., only on KBOO Portland.
Good morning.
My name is Cecil Prescott.
My name is Celeste Carey.
And you're listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO Radio in Portland.
90.7 here in the metro area, 91.9 in Columbia River Gorge, and in the Willamette River Valley, 100.7. What is it on the web?
KBOO.fm.
All right. Point, click, tell your friends.
Let me give you our phone numbers so you're able to participate in our conversation. Call us at 503-231-8187, and you may email us at moretalkradio@gmail.com. Joining us today is Erica Chenoweth, who is an assistant professor at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver, and is an associate senior researcher at the Peace Research Institute of Oslo. Together with Maria J. Steffen, she is the winner of the 2013 Grawemeyer Award for Ideas Improving World Order, which is presented annually in recognition of outstanding proposals for creating a more just and peaceful world. Their book, Why Civil Resistance Work, The Strategic Logic of Nonviolent Conflict, published by Columbia University, also won the 2012 Woodrow Wilson Foundation Award, given annually by the American Political Science Association in recognition of the best book on government, politics, or international affairs published in the U.S. in the previous calendar year. We are pleased to have her with us this morning. And good morning, Dr. Chenoweth.
Good morning.
Perhaps we could begin. We mentioned the book that you've written with your co-author, Maria J.
Steffen. Mm-hmm.
Why Civil Resistance Works, the Strategic Logic of Nonviolent Conflict. And perhaps we could begin by you sharing how you became interested in the study of civil resistance. I assume you did not grow up as a pacifist or a Quaker, or I'm not even sure how you would categorize yourself.
Yeah, well, first of all, I'm delighted to be on the show with you this morning. Thanks for having me. In terms of my background, I actually... I did not grow up as a Quaker or pacifist or from any type of tradition in that regard, and I wouldn't consider myself a pacifist today either, to throw that out there. So I didn't really have any types of philosophical prior beliefs when I approached this study. What happened is it was kind of a happy accident. I was invited to apply to attend a workshop called People, Power, and Pedagogy that was being put on by the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict, which is an educational foundation that tries to disseminate knowledge about the theory and practice of civil resistance. This was back in June of 2006. I was still a graduate student. I was writing my doctoral dissertation on terrorism in democratic countries, and I was a little bit intrigued by especially the fact that they were going to give me free books and free room and board and that I was going to get a week that was more or less a sponsored week to attend this workshop. And so I went, and the thing that really piqued my curiosity was that they were talking about civil resistance as a very active, confrontational, and direct form of civilian-led conflict. And from my very scant knowledge about the topic of nonviolent resistance before, I had always assumed that it was more passive or more of a weak form of conflict. And so they were talking about this powerful force that when unarmed civilians use a variety of well-sequenced tactics, they can actually coerce their opponents, even when they're very repressive states, into, you know, either accommodating their demands or even dissolving itself. So the problem was that I was not totally convinced by this argument, and I found that, you know, a lot of the cases they were mentioning about the People Power Movement in the Philippines and the anti-Milosevic movement and Serbia, I was concerned that maybe these were very unique cases and that maybe they were so-called outliers. And so I suggested to Maria that what would really be convincing would be a study that actually could demonstrate that these movements were actually more effective when you compare them against hard cases like violent insurgencies, and when you limited the study to the hardest cases, the types of nonviolent campaigns that are actually trying to remove an entrenched dictator, trying to expel a foreign military occupation, or trying to secede. And I said, if I saw evidence that they were holding up and succeeding in these cases, I'd be much more convinced by your argument. And so we embarked on the study together. And what we did is we collected data on all of the major nonviolent campaigns all the way back to 1900 and going through 2006 that were seeking the removal of a dictator, foreign territorial occupation being removed from their country, and then secession. And we excluded cases like civil rights campaigns, gender rights, environmental rights, and these sorts of campaigns, because we were trying to find the so-called hardest cases. Mm-hmm. And then we collected the same data on violent insurgencies, and we compared them against each other. These are hundreds and hundreds of campaigns, and we found an extremely strong statistical association between the campaign being primarily nonviolent and it winning. In fact, it's a very striking difference. The nonviolent campaigns over that entire period were more than twice as likely to succeed as the violent insurgencies.
So if I understand you correctly, what you decided to do was to not only quell your own skepticism, but to bring a scientific analysis to the whole the validity of nonviolence. Is that correct?
Well, to be honest, my approach was actually, I didn't even know if I actually didn't expect to find this result at all. In some way, I wanted to find out one way or another whether they were right, and I was actually fine finding out that they weren't right. You know, if I had found that in the data, I didn't have any type of thing that I was hoping to find here. So I was actually kind of shocked when I found that they were so much more effective. And so my motivation in doing this was to more just satisfy my intellectual curiosity. But since then, I've realized what an important finding it is, and I've been fairly passionate about trying to debunk this very conventional myth that people have that violence somehow is more successful or more powerful or gets them what they want faster, or, you know, all of the different myths that people hold about the utility of violence just aren't holding up in our data. So to that extent, just trying to get it right is my primary motivation.
Okay, and the only reason I asked about quelling your own skepticism is that it doesn't sound like initially you had heard of some of the other authors, or they hadn't been prominent in your learning and in your studies, who had advocated nonviolence.
Exactly.
Okay. So how is it that you managed to get quite that far and there was this disconnect with the other voices being prominent?
Yeah, so this is a question that I'm asking a lot of my colleagues now, is why aren't we incorporating more of this literature into our canon? When we teach people about conflict, why are we only teaching people about violence? And actually, I have to say that we've made a lot of inroads with our colleagues and describing the importance of teaching, studying, and researching nonviolent conflict. And I'm happy to say that, you know, a lot of my colleagues in social science have been very convinced by this and are now taking it very seriously and doing their own research. So there is like a movement within my field, at least, of people that are now committed to the notion of getting it right, and that's very exciting.
We're speaking with Erica Jenneworth, co-author with Maria J. Stephan, of Why Civil Resistance Works, the Strategic Logic of Nonviolent Conflict. Our numbers are 503-231-8187. We encourage you to call to respond to Professor Jenneworth's analysis, and also to reflect on why you believe civil resistance work or do not work. I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about what you discovered in your research about why civil resistance is more effective than violent insurgencies.
Mm-hmm. Well, what we did is, after we find this powerful association between the use of nonviolent resistance and success, what we tried to do then is go into each of these campaigns a little bit more deeply and find out what do they look like, what are their characteristics that maybe distinguish them from your average violent insurgency. And what we actually found is that the nonviolent campaigns, the most striking thing that differentiates them is that they're huge. They tend to be, on average, four times larger than the average violent insurgency. And if you buy Gene Sharp's argument the main source of power isn't force but consent, then when this large number of people begin to disobey the authority, begin to collectively challenge its right to rule, and begin to withdraw their consent, this can impose impressive costs on the adversary. It stretches out the costs of repression, for example. Instead of repressing just a few people, the state has to durably repress hundreds of thousands or even millions of people. No matter what they say, every authoritarian leader knows that they cannot repress all of the people all of the time. And that's why they use methods like terror, and why they do sort of horrific public things, because it's easier to control people psychologically than to actually deploy force in a very credible and durable way. An example of this is that another feature that we found that distinguishes the nonviolent campaigns is that they're much more likely to result in defections or disobedience among the security forces. The reason is because security forces inside countries, they will often repress nonviolent campaigns. It's quite normal in our data that this is happening and that it's lethal repression and that it's very intense. But the difference is that over time, they become less likely to continue doing it as a monolithic entity. You start to get people who want to call in sick to work. You start to get people who disobey outright orders to shoot into the crowd. You get upper-level kind of officers that refuse to pass on orders to their subordinates. And so the reason this is happening is because, again, the movements are large. They're so large that these security forces know that they probably have friends, family, kin, or potential future allies in the new order in that crowd demonstrating. And so there comes a point in these campaigns where the sheer size, the sheer mass of the movement starts to create strategic dilemmas and the pillars of support.
Yes.
And they start to assess that if they continue to support the incumbent that whenever this thing falls apart, they're going to be the big time losers, and they change their minds about continuing to remain loyal. So these types of dynamics are much more likely to happen with nonviolent campaigns than with the violent insurgencies. There's a very strong statistical association between large nonviolent campaigns and this crumbling of those pillars of support. And that same association doesn't apply in the violent insurgencies.
Now, when you speak of pillars of support, are you speaking of certain institutions? Are you speaking an institution such as the military? Or is it a little more diffused?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it really kind of depends on which society we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But every power holder relies on people, whether it's economic elites, business elites, the security forces, even educational elites and state media and others, civilian bureaucrats even, they rely on those people in order to maintain the status quo and to maintain their power. And so in every society, you're going to have a little bit of a difference in terms of which pillars of support are the most important. In some cases, it may actually be economic elites rather than the security forces. South Africa would be a good example of that. And in other cases, the security forces are crucial, and Serbia might be a good example of that. So each local campaign knows which pillars are going to be the most vulnerable to getting this kind of strategic dilemma, and they're also going to know which kinds are the most important in their own society.
One thing I noticed that you've written about in your research is what happens after these campaigns. So, for example, if civil resistance overthrows the regime, how effective they will be coming in establishing a lasting democracy as opposed to a violent insurgency. Could you say the differences of the results of these different types of campaigns?
Sure. There's a pretty strong general pattern that in countries that have faced a nonviolent campaign, they're much more likely to emerge from the conflict democratic, even if they're not democracies when the conflict is going on. Within 5 years of the end of the campaign, they're much more likely, something like 75% more likely than countries that have faced violent campaigns, and becoming democratic. And by democratic, we use a pretty traditional political science indicator for that, which is just that they have competitive, free, and fair elections, that they have separation of powers between the executive, the legislature, and the judiciary, and that they allow competition among different political parties, that competition among parties is not restricted, for instance, to one single party. So it's a pretty minimalist definition. We're not looking at kind of liberal culture or anything along those lines, but that's something that can certainly be researched later. The second really important outcome that we found is that countries emerging from a nonviolent campaign are about 15% less likely to relapse into civil war within 10 years. So, it's not a huge effect. It's 15% less likely, but I'd still rather live in a country that had a 15% reduction in civil war likelihood than one that didn't. And then the other thing just to note is that these results hold whether the nonviolent campaign succeeds or not.
That was what I was going to ask. Is there a halfway mark, so to speak, that still indicates to those who are in power and are inclined to be violent that, okay, people are amassing and they're amassing with enough critical mass that they can actually overthrow them at a future move? So can you talk about why it's successful?
Yeah.
I mean, why a partial success is still a success.
Yeah. So, I mean, we still count those as failures because we don't want to give our critics too much ammunition, so to speak.
Right, right.
But what the really interesting thing is that it seems like when a nonviolent campaign fails, if it's achieved this huge mass, for instance, what it might do is, even if it fails, it's empowering reformers within the elite. That are saying, okay, then our number is up. It's only a matter of time. If you want to be a part of this transition going forward, then we better be on the front edge of it, right?
Yes.
So you're looking at cases like Burma today, where, you know, the Saffron Revolution of 2007, we would have coded that as a failure. But I think what it did, and all of the work that Aung San Suu Kyi and the pro-democracy movement had done for years before, is give any type of reformers within the Burmese regime an excuse to say, let's start to open before we are on the wrong side of history here. And so it's largely an internal discussion, but it's one that you can't imagine having happened without mass civilian-based resistance occurring in that country for years.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. We are inviting you to join the conversation. We're talking about why nonviolence works. And the phone number is 503-231-8187. Gives you a chance to speak with Professor Erica Chenoweth.
And before we go to our caller, I think it might be helpful if you would define what you mean by civil resistance and how that differs.
Absolutely. So my definition of civil resistance is it's when unarmed civilians use a variety of tactics like strikes, boycotts, demonstrations, go-slows, and stayaways, and other nonviolent tactics to confront or engage in conflict against an adversary. And the key things that are important are that it's unarmed civilians engaging in collective action that's non-institutional, meaning it's not part of the sort of legal process of, say, a pre-electoral campaign rally in the United States, or a letter-writing campaign, which is totally legal. It's usually happening outside legal institutions. And the other key element is that it's nonviolent, meaning that it's not threatening to physically harm the opponent, and it's not physically harming the opponent. So that's my definition. It's a very strict definition. And again, it's because of the need to maintain as much conceptual clarity as possible so that people can't say, like, you know, that you're calling something civil resistance, but it was actually a huge armed campaign or something like that.
Right.
So we're trying to be pretty strict about the definition, but there are a host of alternative views about what is and isn't nonviolent, for example, and you know, there's a huge debate about that, of course, but for my purposes and for my research purposes, that's how I define it.
Thank you. And we'll go to our callers. Thank you for holding patiently.
Hello.
Am I right? Yes. Yes.
It's a tremendous honor to speak to you, Professor Chenoweth. Thank you so much for the work you've done as a military veteran and a student and practitioner of conflict resolution. I think I speak for many, many people when I say your work is so meaningful and revolutionary, and just thank you. My question is, could you please speak a little bit about the unanswered questions? Where do we need to research from here? And if you don't mind, I'd like to take the question off the air.
Thank you for your call.
Thank you. Okay, so thank you so much for your kind comments. It's very heartening for anybody to hear that their research is having some impact positively, and especially for somebody that has studied a lot of violence, it's just nice to know that there's some positive impact that research can have. In terms of your second question, so there are lots of really important, urgent to me unanswered questions. The first is the question of when and why do armed insurgents stop using it, armed insurgency, and start using civil resistance? So under what conditions do these movements do it? We've seen it happen in a variety of cases, and so the key question is, when does that happen? The second really big question is, how do unarmed civilians confront armed non-state actors with civil resistance? So I think of a variety of examples, like narco traffickers or drug lords in Mexico. You can think about violent insurgent groups that are not rights respecting and that are abusing civilians in a variety of different civil wars. We can imagine private security firms and other types of groups that civilians don't want to be part of their ruling order. And so the question for me is, how do people use these same tactics to confront adversaries whose pillars of support seem invisible? And that's like a huge research question and also kind of a strategic question. And then the third one that I think is something that we really need to know urgently is a question that is comparing, is actually looking at the number of people who die in a civil resistance campaign. And the reason I bring this up is because there's always this debate about can we save more people, for instance, by doing an armed international intervention in Syria? Can we save more people by arming the rebels in Syria? Do more people die, you know, when they are using nonviolent resistance and are at the mercy of a truly brutal regime? And for me, I'm very dubious that of those three different types of scenarios that more people die using civil resistance. I actually think that probably the least people die using civil resistance, and it's an extremely controversial claim. But the reason that I'm making it is because of all of the different mass atrocities that states have perpetrated against unarmed civilians in the 20th century, the vast majority of them were counter-guerrilla, counter-insurgency campaigns, meaning that people had already armed. And that's the vast majority of mass killings. The second most common, of course, is ethnic cleansing type killings, which again are often happening in the context of a counterinsurgency type of scenario where civilians are being caught in the crossfire, so to speak, not that they're actually using nonviolent resistance. So the key question there is, are mass atrocities more likely to occur, essentially, against nonviolent campaigns when compared with violent insurgencies and or international interventions? So those are some three crucial questions that we need answers to, and I'm not going to be able to do it myself, so anybody who's interested and who has the skill set should get on those questions and let us know what you find out.
Or maybe a joint effort.
Right.
Well, as you explore this topic and you share your research, how has it been received among those in your field, you know, those who study terror? Is it new information? Do you find people who may challenge you, or what has been some of the response in your field?
Yeah, I mean, I think in general, people have been extremely positive about this work. We've gotten awards for the book. We got an award from the American Political Science Association, which actually indicates that people in my own field, even the greatest skeptics of this type of thing, are find it very intriguing, at least, and you know, motivating to create a new research field in our world, which is great. In terms of the skeptics, I mean, I think in my field, the biggest skeptics are those that would have maybe done the data collection differently, made different coding choices or that sort of thing. But those are going to always be the arguments, no matter what you're studying. So that, you know, and I've also encouraged people, if you would have coded this case differently, then do so and rerun the results and see what you find and let us know. You know,
has anybody stepped up to that challenge yet?
There are lots of graduate students who are doing some of the coding, and I'm also doing a follow-up project. But I know of multiple different doctoral dissertations underway at the moment that are kind of replicating or extending our findings. And so far, you know, I'm pretty confident that our findings hold up. But we'll see. You know, the thing about a controversial book is that it creates controversy, so people want to kind of reevaluate it, revisit it, and see if it holds up when they change the research design slightly and so forth. And that's exactly what I hope to achieve with this, is that people take it seriously and put the time in to do that so we can develop a really solid empirical body of work. You know, I think in terms of the most surprising response has been the amazing response from just average people that aren't academics, that aren't even activists, but just people that have obtained an interest for some reason in the topic. And, you know, I get tons of emails and phone calls and things from people that just want to talk a little bit about the work. I gave a talk at Notre Dame last week, and it was a full house. It was standing room only. It was people who were already familiar with the work and wanted to hear me talk about it. And that kind of thing always is just so amazing. For somebody to be able to reach such a diverse audience is a real honor. So I think that has been the surprising thing, that the Chronicle of Higher Education had published an article about a year and a half ago that the average academic book is read by like 6 or 7 people or something mm-hmm. horrific like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that hasn't been the case with this book. This book has reached a very large audience, and I think actually it speaks to the power of nonviolent resistance more than the power of our book, so to speak. I think that for a lot of people, they have long felt intuitively that this was the case, but couldn't demonstrate it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's they feel maybe a little bit vindicated in knowing that their intuition was right.
We'll go to our next caller who's been patient. Good morning, Joanne.
Yes, hello. I'm one of your average people here. One of my questions has probably been answered. I was going to ask if this work would work in Mexico with the drug cartels. Also, this program raises up my memory of Representative Dennis Kucinich, who wanted to create a peace department in our government. And just one more thing, and I'll leave the air. I was wondering, have you or anybody done any research with the UN's use of so-called peace troops in other countries? And I'm thinking a little bit about Haiti's experience.
Thank you for bringing up Haiti. That was one I had in mind.
Great. Thank you, Joanne, for your questions. In terms of the question on Mexico, will civil resistance work against the drug war in Mexico? We'll see. There is a civil resistance campaign underway to try to end the drug war, and by that it means to, you know, deprive drug warlords of the means to do what they're doing. It means also stopping the the militarized approach to ending the drug war in Mexico by the government.
But Professor Chenoweth, isn't the drug war one of those groups that fell into your unanswered questions, though?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, because it's totally unanswered. So we don't know yet whether this will have a massive effect on changing the shape of that conflict. But there is one that's underway. So more will be revealed on the longer term effects of that. The second question about I guess your comment more was about the Kucinich's call for creating a Department of Peace.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think that. I don't see it happening, at least in the short term. If you ask the government today, they'll tell you that they're having a little bit of a problem with sequester, which maybe is a bit of a cop out. But overall, I think that I was going to say, of all of the audiences that I've talked to about this work, the most skeptical are civilian defense officials,
mm-hmm.
not uniformed military. Uniformed military totally are all about it. But civilian defense officials are very skeptical for one reason or another. And then your third question, has anybody studied the use of peacekeepers by the United Nations? There have been a few people, and I can tell you the names of the books. The first is a book by Michael Doyle and Nicholas Sambanis, and it's called Making War and Building Peace. And it is about the record of UN peacekeeping, successes and failures, and looking at the long-term impacts of UN peacekeeping. There's another book called Does Peacekeeping Work? And it's by a woman who actually lives in Portland part of the time. Her name is Virginia Page Fortna. She's a professor at the Columbia University.
Mm-hmm.
And the last name is Fortna, Fortna. And the bottom line for both of those seminal studies is that peacekeeping is actually, compared to the alternatives, a very effective way of stopping bloodshed in conflict. And that's true regardless of whether they're so-called peace enforcement missions or the Chapter 7 missions, where peacekeepers go in without the consent of the conflict parties, or whether they are Chapter 6 missions, which is where they go in at the request of the conflict parties. Now, one thing to point out is that Doyle and Sambanis, their bottom line is that you're much more likely to see long-term success in these countries if the missions are so-called multilateral, which means that not only, or I'm sorry, multidimensional.
Yes, okay.
Multidimensional, which means that not only are they, that they're blue helmets, but that they also have a plan for helping the political process along, helping with economic problems, helping with delivering humanitarian aid, healthcare, sanitation, housing. When they actually are a full package type of mission, they're much more likely to both stabilize the country and lead to better longer-term outcomes. And the problem is, of course, that those are the most expensive types of missions. And so they're the less likely to happen in conflicts where the international community doesn't have huge interests. So that's a sad part of it. But the good story is that that UN operations are actually more successful than they get credit for, especially in the media. And the newest book is by Joshua Goldstein, and it's called Winning the War on War. It's a much easier book to read. What it says is that the UN, things don't always work with UN peacekeeping missions. But usually they don't work because they didn't have the resources they need to match their mission. And so what we should be doing is supporting the UN more than we are, and that it's actually doing good work in the world. So those are some of the different arguments that are out there. You could find fault with them, of course, but I'd suggest you take a look at those readings.
You're listening to More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott with my co-host Celeste Carey. We're speaking with Erica Chenoweth, co-author with Maria J. Steffen of Why Civil Resistance Work, The Strategic Logic of Nonviolent Conflict. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. Before we go to Tim, let me remind you that on the OMO Variety Hour at 9, Bill Resnick speaks with Stephen Hellman about Italian politics. Denise Morris explains why poverty is a queer gay issue, particularly in light of the right-wing embrace of gay marriage. Well-read Red Fran Michel reflect on recent controversies concerning voting rights, and Ivan Hale share comments on community mental health. At 10, Ear Cascadia is off. Instead, we'll hear coverage of the recent mass protests against the Keystone Pipeline. At 10:15, Barbara Bernstein talks with Clinton Lindsay, a fifth-generation farmer and local food advocate from Corvallis, Oregon, who is working to pass a voter referendum that will create a food bill of rights in Benton County. At 11 on Health Watch, Dr. David Naiman interviews Victoria Mazes, an expert on women's health and executive director of the Arizona Center for Integrative Medicine, about her book on maximizing fertility and giving birth to a healthy child. At 11:30 on Madness Radio, Will Hall interviewed David Cohen, an expert on adverse effects of psychotropic drugs and on psychiatric drug withdrawals. Thank you, KABU members, for supporting your community radio station. If you're not currently a member of KABU, go to our website, kboo.fm, and click on Donate Now. And as I mentioned, we're speaking with Erica Chenoweth, and we'll go to Tim. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. I was curious about, I guess I'm not really in favor of the UN taking over all these different countries. And I think about, for instance, Syria, what's going on in Syria right now, which appears to be completely illegal, where we have American and other European countries funding rebels against the government. And as far as I know, that's illegal, according to the United Nations. And I just kind of want to probe the idea that a lot of these civil resistances are being backed up by nefarious agencies like the CIA. I mean, we look at the various different colored revolutions that happened in the Eastern European countries and the Arab countries, and it feels like they've been highly manipulated. And you know, kind of going under the cover of nonviolence, yet at the same time being funded by the CIA and others who use their high-tech and sophisticated approaches to manipulate and change cultures and governments in other countries.
Thank you, Tim.
Yes.
Thanks for the questions. So there's always this narrative out there that somehow it's Western agencies, especially the CIA, that is supporting these movements. And I can tell you a couple things. The first is that we actually did take a look at foreign state support for nonviolent campaigns, meaning that we found that they were materially supported by you know, any type of agency by another state. So the support of the Syrian rebels, for instance, we would count as a positive example of where this happened, positive in the sense that it actually happened. What we found is that when foreign states support nonviolent campaigns, it doesn't improve their chances of success at all. So first of all, it deprives them of the local legitimacy that they have among the people that are mobilizing on behalf of the cause. And the second thing is it just creates kind of a straight-up free rider dilemma, which is that, like, I'm not going to go out there and risk my neck if, you know, if I'm doing this for the puppet of, you know, another government. So we actually find very little support empirically for the notion that any type of state aid for nonviolent campaigns helps them. State aid for violent campaigns does help them. It's the one thing that improves their chances of success by about 15%. But the costs, as we clearly outline in our book, in the longer term for these countries is extremely severe. The second thing I would say is that it's kind of hard to reconcile the notion that that the U.S. government is behind a lot of these campaigns when they are directly targeting allies of the United States. so, I mean, the case of Iran, for example, it's hard to justify that the U.S. would be supporting, for instance, a nonviolent campaign against a Shah that it itself was had put in power and was supporting up until the very end. In the case of Egypt, I think it's very dubious that any type of U.S. agency was actively promoting a nonviolent campaign against Mubarak, whose position in the Egyptian government was supported fully by the U.S. and that it, from the U.S. point of view, was protecting the treaty with Israel and other interests in the region for the United States. And so, you know, I think that in a lot of these cases, what you're seeing is nonviolent campaigns that are mobilizing as much against the United States as they are against their own leaders. And so to that extent, it's highly dubious that there would be any type of kind of nefarious support from any U.S. agency, and especially the CIA, which has, I think, not really been engaged in anything related to these campaigns. Some people say that, you know, I've seen claims out there that, for instance, Gene Sharp is a CIA agent, and that is, it's just abjectly false. The problem is that when people make a claim like that, then the burden is on proving that it isn't the case. But if there's literally no evidence for it, you can't disprove it except to have the man show all of his books, his finances and everything else, which if you audited him, you'd find out he's never received any money from any government. And he's fully legit on his own, just doing all these types of research, and he also doesn't give advice to movements. So he just gives them books, which is hardly the same thing as creating or sponsoring a nonviolent campaign. So you know, it's impossible actually to discredit the claims because there's no evidence, you know, out there that shows that it's specifically wrong. That's public evidence, but I can tell you that it's just, from what I've experienced, most of these campaigns, boy, they get really angry when people say that they were supported by Western governments, because they're just as angry at Western governments as they are against their own leaders in most cases.
Thank you, and we'll go to our next caller. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning. I do have to agree with Tim's analysis, but I wanted to get to this political scientist named Michael Parenti, he had a book out called Black Shirts and Reds. And to make a long story short, his argument basically was that instead of looking for saintly revolutionaries who do everything right, you know, and are nonviolent, the truth of history is that you have very unsaintly people like Stalin and Mao who are willing to engage in the dirt, just like the Western imperialist powers, and that we actually benefited from that kind of Maoism, Stalinism, because it created leverage. It created a countervailing force to capital, and that the only way to understand the world since the fall of the Berlin Wall these last 24 years is that poor people, working class people, people in the underdeveloped world, we have no leverage. We have no countervailing force. And that's why we see the rollback in the developed countries of, you know, we see the austerity programs. That's why we see countries being turned into giant sweatshops. So anyone that advocates that working class poor people lay down their arms seems to me just inherently backwards. So I guess I was hoping to get your guest's response to that. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, can I go ahead? Go ahead, Professor. I had a question, but go ahead, please.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, this is a claim that's out there, of course, that you know, that especially poor people who don't have any leverage because of the influence of the capitalist system and everything, that you know, they have to have arms to both protect themselves and to create any meaningful change. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is actually a fundamental tenet of Marxism, and mm-hmm. so what we've demonstrated in this research is we have actually compared poor people's movements for change side by side in a way. I mean, most of the campaigns that we're talking about, where we're looking at either anti-dictator campaigns or anti-foreign occupation campaigns, if you wanted to call them imperialist occupations, you could call mm-hmm. many of them that. What we find is that, you know, when we do compare the records of these campaigns, the nonviolent campaigns, against the ones that are taking up arms, that won't put down their arms and are confronting these governments with violence, that the nonviolent campaigns are outperforming them by 2-1.
Well, and, Professor Chua, can I ask just a basic question? One of the things that it seems that the caller missed was the whole idea of those who don't have arms doing things like slowdowns or sit-down right. strikes.
There are extremely powerful methods of nonviolent action that have been found to be very effective in actually using the leverage that the poor classes have, which is the slowdown, the mm-hmm. stay-at-home strikes, creating strike funds so that people can both strike and still get what they need to feed their families and these sorts of things. People have been remarkably inventive, and these mm-hmm. types of methods actually matter. They actually do influence the adversary quite directly. If you imagine South Africa as an example of where all of the black townships in South Africa boycotted white businesses downtown, I mean, this was an example of where the people had literally no leverage except for that. That was the only piece of society that they could actually influence and force change, which they did using those types of methods. So, you know, the claim, I understand that the concerns about the claim that you ask poor people to put down their weapons, you make them even more vulnerable. What our research demonstrates is that that's not the case, that they are vulnerable when they put down their weapons and they don't resist.
Well, see, one of the problems that it would seem, and I don't know if you've touched on this before, is that there is a certain risk that comes with either choice, violent or nonviolent.
Yeah.
And so the risk of death exists in both choices.
That is absolutely true. That's absolutely true. And actually, a lot of times the risk of death exists when you're not doing anything at all, right?
Right, collateral damage.
Exactly. Or when it's just a really nasty, brutal regime. So the choices are do nothing, resist violently, resist nonviolently. And so in any case, people are going to make calculations about which of those is going to be both the most risky but also the most likely to produce change. And so what Maria and I are simply arguing is that what the historical record shows is that, you know, there's going to be some serious risks to your physical well-being, regardless of which of those you choose. The one that seems to be correlated with the highest amount of success is the nonviolent resistance. Mm-hmm. So if that's the basis on which people are deciding to resist effectiveness, then this seems to be the best choice from historical data.
I think one of the things that your research let us know is that I think many people either dismiss civil resistance because they might say that it's not effective and they are not persuaded by moral arguments. I think one of the things that you and your partner have demonstrated is on pragmatically that you have the data that proves that it is an effective and oftentimes more effective than other forms of resistance. So if that's the case, where do you go from here with this information? An earlier caller mentioned a proposal from former Representative Kucinich about a State Department of Peace. And are there ears open in the U.S. establishment or the military to hear some of these suggestions?
Yes. So my co-author, Maria Stephan, now works in the State Department. She's working with the Syrian opposition at the moment in Turkey to try to help them with their political capacity building and these sorts of things. And I think that both of us have found a very receptive audience in different parts of the U.S. government. I teach. That's my primary medium for spreading ideas, and I'm teaching a class on civil resistance now, and my students are master's and PhD students who will hopefully then go on and, you know, do their own research and practice in this matter. And, you know, I wouldn't want to say, and I'd be kind of scared to promote the idea that nonviolent resistance always works. We show that it definitely doesn't always work, right? Mm-hmm. But that compared with the alternatives, it's more effective. And the second thing is that it's really important to note about our book that we are only looking at campaigns that have sort of already reached a certain level of maturity in terms of the numbers of people that are involved. So, you know, if you're a nonviolent campaign of 12 people, the implication you should take from our book is definitely not that you're more likely to succeed. but basically, the story is that I do a lot of writing, I do a lot of talking to public audiences and things about this research. Like I said, our book is a beginning; it's not the end of this research program. And so, I hope that people, you know, just spread the word and try to take it seriously as they can and keep an open mind. I know that for myself, all of my prior beliefs showed me that this research couldn't possibly be right because of the way that I'd been trained and because of the way that I thought about the way the world works. And it did take me a little while to come to terms with the fact that I had to change my mind. And so I would encourage people to be open to having their minds changed by the historical record. And I guess that's where I'll leave it.
One final question. One of the things that I gather from listening to you and some of the research I've done is that this is kind of like a coming together of people and building social capital of I can on a very large basis. And if I understood you correctly, you said that one of the reasons that this movement is successful, nonviolence is successful, is that people come together and they start sharing a common vision about what can be done, and they start looking at the costs of what can be done. If a person who is listening right now wanted to translate that into small local action, what would be some ways that you might suggest that they start?
Yeah, so this is always kind of hairy for me because I'm not an activist and I'm really bad at tactical type of questions, but I can tell you just a couple general guiding principles. The first is organization is super important. And, you know, it reminds me of an idea that some friends of mine have told me about in their campaign in Serbia, which was that 95% of what they did was organizing and only 5% of what they did was actions. And in that respect, they were organizing, they were getting people involved, going door to door, talking with people, hearing their stories, and creating a broad vision for what types of goals people shared, even people that didn't have the same political beliefs, but that they, the goals that they shared in their society. And then developing a strategy, so thinking strategically. And, you know, one of the key insights from our from the historical record is that the average nonviolent campaign takes about 3 years to run its course. And I think a lot of times when people are trying to make change, they have too high a standard of what they should be able to accomplish in a short amount of time.
Yes.
So they think if we haven't won in 6 months, then we've failed. But actually, it's usually a much more long-term kind of process, and so I'd say people should think long term and try to develop a strategic plan that would put their tactics in order in a way that makes sense. The third thing I would say is that explore the diversity of and flexibility and versatility of different types of nonviolent methods that are available to different groups of people. Gene Sharp, of course, famously published his list of 198 mm-hmm. methods of nonviolent action back in the 70s, and since then many more have been added. And I think that this is a really interesting way for movements to kind of creatively think about how they can use whatever they have at their disposal to make change. So just take a look through those methods and see what people have used around the world. It's really astonishing and can often create new ideas as well. So, I mean, I think those are the three guiding principles. And then, of course, you know, there's a lot that goes into preparation, which in some contexts includes things like preparing people to deal with repression.
Yes.
And overcoming fear and creating discipline in the movement. It should be thought of as a military campaign, not just, you know, a group of people who are going to win because they're on the right side. We definitely don't find that people win because they're on the right side.
Hey,
thank you so much. Yes. Thank you, Professor Chenoweth.
Sure.
And you've been listening to More Talk Radio here on your Community Connection, KBOO. Stay tuned for the Old Mo Variety Hour.
Mondays at midnight, the Tiki Cha Cha Club is a musical dream world, a place deep inside your mind where everything old is new again, and you might even grow nostalgic for places you've never been to before. That's every Monday at midnight, only on KBOO Portland. Dancer.
The Community for Earth and Economic Justice Action Group and Alliance for Democracy will screen Bitter 70 on March 8th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1011 Southwest 12th Avenue. In 2008, University of Utah economics student and Unitarian Universalist Tim DeChristopher committed an act which would redefine patriotism in our time. Follow Tim, Bitter 70, from college student to incarcerated felon. He bid millions of dollars he didn't have to save thousands of pristine acres of land surrounding U.S. national parks. KBOO Community Radio is a proud media sponsor of this film screening. More information can be found at kboo.fm/bitter70film2013.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is 9:01 a.m. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Merrillhurst University's new Bachelor of Arts in Media and Film Studies, where you can explore how media in all forms affect not only how we view the world, but how we shape it. You'll learn the power of media, how you can use that power to become a participant in change. Now accepting applications. Details at merrillhurst.edu/KBOO.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Tuned to 90. Good morning. You're tuned to 90.7 FM Portland and are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm your host, and our engineer is Mr. Sam. The Old Mole is devoted to bringing you top-notch analyses of social problems and opportunities for acting on those problems. The Movie Moles review movies, and our Book Moles review books, and we all bring some perspective on the creative products that perpetuate ideologies while stimulating imaginations in our culture. We also bring you interviews with activists and scholars concerned with radical transformations of society for human and ecological well-being. That's why on today's show, we start out with an interview between Bill Resnick and Stephen Ellman about Italian politics, focusing on the recent election of the charismatic populist leader Beppe Grillo. Ivan Hale shares a commentary on the state of community mental health. Fran Michel brings us The Well-Read Red, which reviews recent Supreme Court decisions about voting rights and places them in the context of conservative visions of unregulated democracy. Now, without further ado, Old Mole Bill Resnick discusses Italian politics with Stephen Hellman. Bill?
Steve Hellman, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Steve Hellman teaches at York University in Toronto, Canada. He studies Italian and